Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Charles Hennekins, who is the first Sir Richard Dahl Professor and Senior Academic Advisor here at the Schmidt Medical College. Dr. Hennekins comes from Harvard University, where he was a professor there for many years, and this morning he's going to give us a talk on the updates of statins and aspirin in the treatment and prevention of cardiovascular disease.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your kind introduction. I have to apologize. I'm just recovering from an URI, so my voice kind of cuts out a little, but we'll give it our best shot. Healthcare providers in general and primary healthcare providers in particular are the backbone of the medical care system. As you'll hear from my comments, you're providing more benefit for more people than, in my view, ever before in our history. In my career, I've been first a clinician, then second a teacher, and third a researcher. My father dropped dead when I was young from sudden cardiac death. My mother lived to a ripe old age. I see Dr. Santa Maria here, was her doctor many years ago. She saw me once on 2020, said I had a great smile, but was hopeful that I would go back to being a real doctor again. So I want to tell you that once I accepted the reality that it's better to be over the hill than under the hill, my life's been the best ever. And I've lived already 11 years longer than any other man in my family. And we're fortunate here in this community with, I can tell you from the end of the Schmidt College of Medicine, I watched Jen Foster, Lisa Martinez, Dawn Sherling, Joanna Droros, really competent and compassionate physicians. And in the community, the ones who've helped me the most, that's not to be exclusive of anybody, but Nick Brewer, Basil Kiefer, Mike Camerata, Mark Rubenstein, and Larry Fiedler have been extraordinarily competent and compassionate physician. So I think this kind of collegiality and collaboration will be best for our residents who are struggling with their career choices. I would say to the residents, by the way, although it may not appear to be the case to you, at least for me, the biggest thing of my whole professional career was going to med school, and everything since then has been trivial molecular biology, frankly. So keep up the good work and don't get discouraged. So we always tell, I don't have any conflicts of interest here, although I must tell you as a lifelong academic, I think our big problems are more intellectual than financial conflicts most of the time. And by that I mean, we get attached to a particular hypothesis, and despite beautiful hypotheses slain by ugly facts, we tend to dig in with them. And I think we've got to look at the totality of evidence and make our decisions on the basis of all that evidence. So this is you every day. You're the frog in the mouth of this pelican, never giving up and against all odds, as I said, doing more good for more people than ever before in the history of American medicine, in my view. I do have a chapter that I wrote with Mark Rubenstein and another with Sarah Wood that has a lot of the material I'll present. If any of you is interested, I'd be glad to send you a PDF of it. And you can just email me. I should tell you that half a lifetime ago, Sarah and her boyfriend, then Mark, were my first year medical students at Harvard Med School. It's hard to believe all this time has passed, but it sure has. So I talked to you about the totality of evidence. As has been the case with statins and aspirin, advances in knowledge proceed on several fronts and optimally simultaneously. Basic researchers in the lab provide us with explanations to explain why an exposure reduces premature deaths. Clinicians are providing enormous benefit to affected patients by the applications of advances in diagnosis and treatment, and are formulating the best ideas or hypotheses from their own clinical experiences, their case reports, and case series. Clinical investigators are testing the relevance of basic research to healthy individuals and individual patients, and epidemiologists optimally working with basic researchers, clinicians, and clinical investigators formulate hypotheses from their descriptive studies and test them in analytic studies, case control, or cohort. Now, these are very useful to test hypotheses of moderate to large effects. So when my mentor, Richard Dahl, and Austin Bradford Hill were looking at smoking and lung cancer in a case control study, and the relative risk is about 20, it doesn't matter if it's 18, 20, or 22. We can easily pick it up. Even with current smoking and heart disease, where the relative risk is about 2, it doesn't matter if it's 1.8, 2.0, or 2.2. But the drugs of life-saving benefit that I'm going to talk to you about today, here we're trying to distinguish between 0.8, a 20% benefit, 1.0, no effect, or 1.2, 20% harm. Here, the amount of uncontrolled and uncontrollable confounding that's inherent even in the best designed case control and cohort studies. Large designed a priori to test hypotheses, they're still only hypotheses generating for small to moderate effects. We simply need randomized evidence. So they contribute to an overall totality of evidence, and we make the most rational individual decisions for patients and policy decisions for the health of the public. So the good news about our life expectancy, it's the highest ever. It's due mainly the leading causes of mortality in the U.S. and becoming so worldwide are heart disease and stroke. And most of the improvements in our life expectancy have been in the early diagnosis and aggressive treatment of cardiovascular disease. That accounts for over 90%, and most of it is attributable to what you're doing in your practices every day, not to the health of the general public on their own. Also, selective improvements in cancer mortality, the second leading cause of death, mainly leukemias, lymphomas, breast, prostate, remarkable improvements. But as I've indicated, the state of our health is not at an all-time high. And in fact, for the first time in the last 50 years, life expectancy is no longer increasing. And it's not a surprise, really. Now, heart disease becomes the leading killer in men by 45, with sudden cardiac death the first presenting symptom in 1 in 4. It becomes number one in women by 65. If you ask the average woman what she fears most, she'll say with good reason, breast cancer. 1 in 8 women gets breast cancer in her lifetime, but less than 1 in 25 will die from breast cancer. So as you can see, there are more lung cancer deaths than breast cancer deaths, and much more cardiovascular deaths, coronary heart disease deaths, than both of them combined. Now, with other colleagues, some at the Schmidt College of Medicine, we've been increasingly concerned about the role of overweight and obesity. Dedicated, conscientious female nurses, 30 to 55, that entered the nurses' health study, their average height was 5'4", and average weight 164 pounds. That translates to a BMI, or weight in kilograms divided by height in meters squared, of over 27. In addition, the average American gains about 10 pounds for every decade of life. So if you have a patient in middle age with an unexpected weight loss of more than 10 pounds, it may be a harbinger of doom. Some people have said we don't have to worry as much about obesity, but in fact, this is methodologically unsound, because in the cohort studies, if you fail to control for smoking, which decreases weight and increases metabolic rate, you would come to the false conclusion that gaining weight's not so bad because the smokers are thinner and die younger. we control for the direct effects of obesity, hypertension, dyslipidemia, insulin resistance leading to diabetes. And then we say, well, if it doesn't do that, maybe it's not as bad. And then lastly, every cohort study during the first 2 years, the thinnest people have preclinical illness that's going to lead to selective early mortality. And unless you exclude those from the analysis, you'd come to the erroneous conclusion that overweight and obesity may not be so bad. So men and women with overweight and obesity have lipid blood pressure and insulin resistance, a precursor of diabetes. As you well know from your practice, high triglycerides seem like a better predictor of onset of diabetes than anything else over the next few years. In a random sample of the U.S. population over age 40, 40% of adults have this syndrome. So you'll hear the debate about statins, the debate about aspirin comes to the lowest risk people, and where does the benefit exceed the risk? But this is in a population where 40% of people have metabolic syndrome, which confers a risk that's almost as high as a patient who's already survived a prior heart attack. And as you can see by the trends, it's about 30% in your 40s, 40% in your 50s, 50% in your 60s. Not surprisingly, then it goes down because of selective early mortality of those with high BMIs. So significant weight loss is essential, whether by diet and increased activity, drug therapies, or bariatric surgery. In addition, in adolescents, they're smoking more, more obese, more physically inactive, and have more type 2 diabetes already than any generation since the 1950s. It's possible that they may be the first generation of Americans to have higher cardiovascular risk than their parents did since the 1950s. If I told you there was a magic pill that would help with weight, blood pressure, lipids, diabetes, other chronic diseases, arthritis, mood, energy, sleep, and sex life, people would buy it on the home shopping network, but it's small amounts of physical activity. All we need is to be walking 20 minutes a day or every other day, which can be done into the oldest old, and yet 80% of Americans do not achieve this level of regular activity. So you on the firing lines every day fighting against all these obstacles, in theory, especially the 60% without metabolic syndrome, therapeutic lifestyle changes may avoid the need for drugs of life-saving benefit. In theory, we could reduce LDL by 30 to 40%. In practice, we achieve less than 5%. So don't let the perfect be the enemy of the possible. The perfect is the therapeutic lifestyle changes. The possible is what you're doing every day on the firing lines, the early diagnosis and aggressive treatment of these high-risk people. Unfortunately, this is better living through chemistry, not healthy lifestyles, but you've got to keep in mind the big picture. In the United States today, the majority of overweight, physically inactive people are being treated with neither therapeutic lifestyle changes nor the drugs of proven benefit. So this is a huge clinical and public health problem. So you've seen this slide perhaps many times because every case control and cohort study shows the same thing. This is the risk with regard to total cholesterol predicting heart disease mortality. And in the United States, until the year 2000, the average cholesterol was 220 to 230. And you can see that's a pretty substantial risk. My friend and colleague Bill Castelli and I were on numerous panels together where I said, Bill, what's the level in Framingham below which you don't see heart disease? He says a total cholesterol of 150. But you see that in epidemiology, for the longest time, we've seen that a 10% lowering of cholesterol associated with a 20 to 30% reduction in mortality from heart disease. We just haven't had randomized evidence to really support it until the last 5 years or so. My colleague, mentor, and friend, Sir Richard Peto, went into rural China, where the average cholesterol is 140. Those who had 10% lowered, 126, had lowered risks of heart attacks and occlusive strokes. So we've known for a long time that lower was better, and there might not be a threshold. And as you know from Ansel Keys and other descriptive studies, seven-country studies, that in many, perhaps most parts of the world, until the westernization of Eastern countries, you were born with a low cholesterol and with a LDL of about 50, and it stayed that way for most of your life. Now we drive it up through poor diet, no exercise, weight gain, and now we're asking you to drive it down with drug therapies. So the statins, for many years when I was a resident, people knew that elevated lipids were bad, but most of the therapies did more harm than good. So the statins were a major breakthrough, and the early generation, simvastatin or Zocor, pravastatin or Pravacol, lovastatin or Mevacor, drugs of life-saving benefit with great benefit-to-risk ratios back in the 90s to 2000s. Interestingly, in all these studies that showed benefit from high-risk secondary all the way down to low-risk primary, it usually took 2 or 3 years before you began to see the benefit with the earlier generation statins. And we'll keep this in mind. But now, with the advent of atorvastatin or Lipitor and rosuvastatin or Crestor, a different picture emerges. In the PROVE-IT trial of people who had just recovered from an acute coronary syndrome, in those days, the level that the guidelines said you should get it to was 97. And believe it or not, Bristol-Myers Squibb, the makers of Pravacol, pravastatin 40, a very effective and safe drug, said we want to go up against atorvastatin 80, because even though it might lower the lipids more, there are these other pleiotropic effects that may kick in and may show that it's at least as good or better. I personally told them at the time that I thought this was an error because most of the evidence showed that the lower the LDL, the better. And if there were pleiotropic effects, and I believe there are, that they're probably related somehow directly or indirectly to the amount of LDL lowering. So this was a trial funded by Bristol-Myers Squibb. So it was comparing an LDL of 62 to 97. And over the 2-year period of the trial, there was a significant incremental benefit in those that were driven down to 62. John LaRosa in the TNT trial studied 80 milligrams of atorva against 10 milligrams of atorva. I chaired the Data and Safety Monitoring Board for the TNT trial, and by the turn of this century, believe me, our chief concerns were there side effects of keeping these LDLs down in the 70s, because this was revolutionary at the time. So the atorva 10 got to the goal of 101, but those in the atorva 80 group got to 77, and they had significantly lower risk of heart attacks and strokes, the primary endpoints. My former student Paul Ritger did something that was quite extraordinary with rosuvastatin or Crestor at 20 milligrams. He took moderate risk primary prevention subjects where the goal of the statin at that time was 130 LDL, certainly not down to 100, which was the goal for secondary prevention. So the average LDL in the patients enrolled, over 55% of which had metabolic syndrome, by the way, was 109, and he drove it down to 55 with rosuvastatin 20. The Data Monitoring Board, after 1.9 years, stopped that trial because there was a 44% highly significant reduction in the primary pre-specified endpoint. There were significant reductions in MI, in stroke, and in revascularizations on their own, and also, even though it was only 2 years of treatment and follow-up, a significant 20% reduction in total mortality, with similar benefits in women and in men. Well, my colleagues from Oxford have done meta-analyses of trials designed to test the question of reductions in clinical events. And in this case, the meta-analyses could be hypothesis testing because they're just looking at trials designed to test the question. As a methodologic aside, trials that are not designed to test the question, when you do meta-analyses, you're generating hypotheses. When you do meta-analyses of observational studies, especially for the residents, remember these case controls and cohort studies are not internally randomized. There's uncontrolled and uncontrollable confounding in them. When you put them together, you surely reduce the role of chance. You surely increase the bias and confounding. But these are trials designed to test that question. You can see that heart attack is down by 30%, stroke by 15, stents and bypass by 25, coronary deaths by 22. That's in 130,000 people in the placebo-controlled trials. In 40,000 patients randomized to higher versus lower statin, the addition of a more intensive statin therapy gives an incremental benefit over the usual statin. And then, of course, the controversial one in a subgroup analyses of the primary prevention trials where people have 10-year risks of 7%. Generally, people believe that if the 10-year risk is 10% or greater, it's a no-brainer that they would benefit from statins. But even those with a 7% risk seem to have incremental benefits on MI, stroke, and deaths. And the Oxford group felt that there is no level of LDL below which you don't see incremental benefits. And here are the data on those low-risk patients. You can see reductions in vascular events, coronary events, revascularizations. Now, of course, the scourge for clinicians is the patient's side effects from the statins. Hepatic side effects came into vogue because of FDA concerns over the 40 milligrams of simvastatin or Zocor used in the 4S trial. They have been largely mitigated by reassuring evidence on atorvastatin and rosuvastatin, so much so that in May of 2015, the FDA now does not any longer recommend periodic monitoring of liver enzymes as being useful. In fact, keep in mind in your practice, if your patients have metabolic syndrome and they have elevations of their enzymes due to fatty livers that occur with metabolic syndrome, those enzyme elevations will actually go down with the statins. The hardest thing for clinicians is the perception of muscle side effects, because there are a lot of patients who have muscle symptoms, very few of which have accompanying enzyme elevations. And also, there are large and, to me, still unexplained discrepancies between the randomized evidence and the self-reports. Claims data, of course, now claims data are collected for administrative purposes, not to test hypotheses. So again, for the residents, don't ever believe that claims data can be useful for anything except raising questions, because there's inherent uncontrolled and uncontrollable confounding. Pito, who in many ways is like Mozart, says about claims data, if you torture the data enough, they'll confess. But what are they confessing to? They just want you to stop torturing them. So in the randomized evidence, for example, in TNT, 80 versus 10 milligrams of atorvastatin, you don't really see any excess of muscle symptoms. You don't see any excess of rhabdo. In the Meteor trial of Robin Krauss, almost 1,000 patients with carotid occlusions were randomized to 40 milligrams of rosuvastatin, or Crestor, the highest dose of the most potent marketed statin, for 2 years. there was significant reduction in progression of atherosclerosis as measured by ultrasound, a suggestion of some regression beginning at 2 years. And Steve Nissen has weighed in on this in another uncontrolled case series with 40 milligrams of Crestor. Now, the important thing for you in practice is, not surprisingly, 1 in 8 of the people on 40 milligrams of rosuvastatin said their muscles were hurting so badly they had to stop the drug. But 1 in 8 of the patients on placebo said their muscles were hurting so much they had to stop the drug. And yet, in your practice, these are real. This is a scourge for clinicians. Patients are having these symptoms, and I'll give you my formula for how to deal with it in a minute. I opine that the direct-to-consumer advertising has really hurt clinicians trying to treat patients, because the Federal Trade Commission says, yes, you can talk about the benefits, but you must talk about every potential side effect and end your ad with the potential side effects. So most of those ads we see on TV, the people remember the last part, which is it may cause disabling muscle symptoms. This is mindful of what happened with in the 70s and 80s with the manufacturers of acetaminophen or Tylenol, who made everyone aware of the GI side effects of aspirin. To this day, if you ask many patients, what do you think is the amount of GI side, what proportion of people will get GI upsets with 325 of aspirin a day? And they'll say maybe 25%. And indeed, that's the proportion you see in the placebo group over 5 years. You see 29% in the active group. So in fact, the amount attributable to aspirin is not 1 in 4, but 1 in 25, 4%. But there's discrepancies between clinical experience and the randomized evidence. So Brian Brewer, who is a member of the NCEP3 panel, showed here what this slide shows, is that if you control for the amount of LDL lowering, there are actually less side effects with rosuvastatin and atorvastatin than there are with simvastatin, pravastatin, and lovastatin. So in fact, these are the drugs that have the evidence base that go with them. And in fact, you saw the benefits in PROVIT and in TNT and in JUPITER, beginning within a month of starting the therapy, which is a significantly different pattern from what you saw with the earlier generation statins. So I don't have any magic bullets here. Certainly, I think you should stop the statin being prescribed when the patient has statin intolerance. And frankly, my view is that why re-challenge them with the same statin since they already think they're having a problem with it? I would certainly get the CKs. 95 to 99% of the time, they won't be elevated. Or if they are elevated, they're more likely related to the exercise they did. And some people will say, well, I don't really exercise that much, but you know, my trainer came, I lifted a few weights this morning. That will raise the enzymes as well. So from a pharmacodynamic perspective, there are lipophilic and hydrophilic statins. The most prominent of the lipophilic is atorvastatin. The most prominent of the hydrophilic is rosuvastatin. And these two have the best benefit-to-risk ratios, in my view, based on currently available evidence. So if they're on one, I would switch to the different one. You could say honestly that in pharmacodynamic studies, they have different affinities, and maybe this will help, maybe it won't. I would decrease the daily dose. I would certainly choose lower doses for Asians and all subjects of smaller statures. I would try alternate day dosing. I would try the addition of coenzyme Q or ubiquinol. It's certainly diminished in the serum with statin use, but no randomized evidence to say that replenishing it helps. But if the patient feels it helps and it's going to keep them on the drug, I would do it. There are no magic ways to get around this. Now, if you look at the totality of evidence, you can see, even on quantity, we have 210,000 patients in the statin trials that have been randomized and followed for now 10 years. Niacin, much less, and in the coronary drug project, which was in the pre-statin era, a benefit with a lot of perceived side effects and liver enzyme elevations. More recently, in the presence of statins, no incremental benefits. Omega-3 fatty acids showing incremental benefits, added to 10 of PRAVA or 5 of SIMVA, but maybe not likely to show a benefit when added to 40 of Rasuvo or 80 of Atorva. Fibrates, Gemfibrozil, a benefit in GA hit, but really unacceptably high side effects. Phenofibrates, extremely safe drugs. I sat on the data monitoring board of the field trial in diabetics. We saw benefits emerging on cardiovascular events in field. But then with NSEP3 elevating diabetes from a risk factor to a risk equivalent, 58% of the people in field went on a statin. By the end of the field trial, there was no significant overall effect. And in subgroup analyses useful to generate but not test hypotheses, you see in the proportion of patients who didn't take a statin a significant benefit, and the proportion who did, no suggestion of any incremental benefit with the statin. My colleagues at Harvard in the IMPROVE IT trial were trying to show that ezetimibe or Zetia would add to the benefit of high doses of simvastatin. They thought that they could study about 10,000 patients for about 3 years. They wound up studying 18,000 for 6 years and did show a significant 6% incremental benefit of ezetimibe. But the point of this slide would be, as I'll tell you in a moment, my view of the totality of evidence is treat with the evidence-based dose of the statin to goal and then see what you're left with, and then add the adjunctive therapy based on the individual patient's characteristics. So the statins do produce net benefits in secondary and primary. I think there is debate about absolute benefit to risk and benefit to cost in low-risk primary prevention subjects, but there are two points to be made here. Women have the same benefit as men at equivalent risks, and remember, 40% of adult men and women have metabolic syndrome, so let's not argue about that 7% to 10% group, because those metabolic syndrome patients have 18 to 20% risk. And of course, they should be an adjunct, not an alternative to the lifestyle changes. And as you can see, this is my own private little algorithm in your clinical management. The highest risk patients are going to benefit from 80 of Atorva or 40 of Rasuva. The moderate risk, 20 to 40 of Atorva, 10 to 20 of Rasuva. The lowest risk, 10 to 20 of Atorva, 5 to 10 of Rasuva. But there is no level of LDL in the observational studies below which there are no benefits. And in the trials, the same thing is true. The randomized data are primarily in patients with statins. The randomized data achieve LDL levels in the 50s. The population data, as I told you before, also suggest that 50 is where most people in the world used to be before the westernization. The westernization is occurring at such an alarming rate that cardiovascular disease is now becoming the number one killer in the world. It's overtaken all of the causes, even in China and in Japan, in India, in urban India especially. Here you're seeing astronomically high risk when you introduce the Western lifestyle, and that's being studied by my colleague and friend Salim Yusuf at McMaster. Now, you've heard a lot about the PCSK9 inhibitors. I had the opportunity to chair the data monitoring board for the Amgen agent, evolocumab. They are really, when added to 80 milligrams of atorvastatin, they have demonstrated a 60% greater reduction in LDL and reductions in clinical CVD events. But remember, these have been studied over 26 months when given as a monthly injection. The randomized safety data include about 26 weeks of treatment and follow-up. The most commonly reported side effects are joint pain, allergic reactions, and fatigue. And, of course, another scourge for the clinicians who's thinking about, should I use it in the patients who just can't take any statin? The annual cost is about $14,000, not covered by insurance. Diabetes is the major risk factor for cardiovascular disease. In fact, it's said that in women especially, it takes away women's far lower absolute risk of heart disease. A diabetic woman's risk is 4 to 6-fold higher than her counterpart. A man is only 2 to 3. The CARDS trial of diabetics in primary prevention was terminated early due to the emergence of a statistically extreme 37% reduction in the primary pre-specified endpoint. With regard to statins and diabetes, even assuming causality, there's a 9 to 13% observed increase. Even if that's real, that's low compared to the potential benefits. And in fact, another thing that makes it harder for you in your practice, the NSAP guidelines now have elevated diabetes to a risk equivalent, asking you to treat them as aggressively as your patients who survived an event. So, of course, there's a multifactorial approach to treating diabetes. I personally feel, and the Joslin people are in agreement, avoid and treat overweight and obesity, get a more active lifestyle, get the drug therapies to prevent the macrovascular complications, and then address the microvascular complications that come with control of the blood sugar. Now, with Mark Pfeffer and Pat Hebert, we speculated a long time ago that atherosclerosis, the principal underlying cause, which is benefited by statins, and thrombosis, the principal proximate cause, which is benefited by aspirin, might lead to additive benefits of the statins. And we were given access to the pravastatin pooling project. So you can see, when a statin was randomized to the patients on aspirin, you got an incremental benefit above the statin alone. When aspirin was added to the statin patients, you get an incremental benefit. With regard to the aspirin alone, you saw it on MI, you saw it on stroke, you saw it on the combined endpoint. In fact, with Donald Berry, the chief of statistics at MD Anderson, we asked him to talk about just how additive were the benefits, and he decided that the probability of synergy between these drugs was 92%. So turning to aspirin, Hippocrates found that an extract produced by the bark of the white willow tree would relieve aches and pains, later found to have aspirin-like qualities. In fact, my colleague at NIH said, you know, aspirin's even older than medicine itself. Because when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, he was told to take 2 tablets and come back in the morning. So we do have, basically, it became the most widely used drug in the world after being synthesized by Felix Hoffman in the laboratories of Bayer. But it wasn't until John Vane, who won the Nobel Prize in 1980, he demonstrated in 71 that small amounts of aspirin will irreversibly acetylate platelet-dependent cyclooxygenase for the life of the platelet, and that higher doses, in his view, provided no additional benefits. So based on the totality of evidence that includes, again, hundreds of thousands of patients randomized in many trials of secondary prevention, we need a lot more use of aspirin in anyone who's had an MI, an occlusive stroke, a TIA, stable or unstable angina, all patients suffering acute MI, all patients suffering an occlusive stroke. In ICES-2, I was the U.S. principal investigator for this study, we found that the 35-day pre-specified endpoint was mortality. There was a 23% reduction in the aspirin takers, 25% in the streptokinase takers, and basically 42%. Now, it doesn't matter whether you come in 1 hour or up to 24 hours after onset of symptoms. You will get a 23% reduction in mortality. Remember, you need a 325 aspirin. You need regular aspirin. Enteric-coated is touted as having less GI side effects, but I must tell you, in the randomized trials, especially of the high stature people, they look like — I did this with Steve Borzak and Ricky Schneider here years ago, and Garrett Fitzgerald did a randomized study designed to test the question. We formulated it, Garrett tested it, that the high stature people behave like people who are not on aspirin. You don't get the antiplatelet effect with the lowest dose of enteric aspirin. But at any rate, as clinicians, we always want to know who's going to benefit the most. So we start cutting up the data and looking for different groups who will benefit. So Pito being Pito, and he is like Mozart, he and Stephen Hawking were probably the two smartest people I've ever met in my entire life. I had the honor to spend a year there with Dahl and Pito. So we found it in women and men. We found it in the elderly and middle age, the diabetics and non-diabetics, in the hypertensives and non-hypertensives. But Pito being Pito did find one subgroup where aspirin was of no benefit when given during acute MI. It's the patients born under the birth sign Gemini and Libra. Look at this. We have a much more significant finding for the other birth signs, but nothing, a 9% non-significant possible adverse effect. The question is, would you withhold the aspirin on the basis of this data? It looks like there's nothing going on here. It's a very good methodologic point. I happened to be sitting on a plane with Dr. Joyce Gilson, a prominent astrologer, who was then, and I asked her what she would think if I told her there were people who didn't benefit from aspirin. She said, "Oh, I believe that's true." I said, "Which ones would that be?" She said, "I don't play those games. Just tell me." I said, "They're Geminis and Libras." She said, "That's exactly what I would have predicted." So then I said, well, being the lifelong academic, well, what we have here is data-derived hypothesis generation from ISIS-2. In the Physicians' Health Study, we were the first to demonstrate aspirin prevents first heart attack. I said, "You think we'll see the same thing?" She said, "Absolutely." She gave me her card. We looked at the data. We found every birth sign benefited except Scorpios. I never heard from her again. So now this totality of evidence in secondary prevention, you see reductions in MI and stroke and serious vascular events. The big thing as clinicians, you got to realize the risks of another event are like 20% or so. The side effect risk of aspirin is very small in comparison. So the benefit, the absolute benefit to absolute risk is huge in favor of aspirin in secondary prevention or during acute MI. But despite this, I did a study with Nancy Cook and found that in secondary prevention, only 50% were taking the medication. And those who thought they were taking aspirin, some were on NSAIDs, and work I'm doing with Manas Rana and Jen Foster, I'll get to in a minute. This will only work while the metabolites in the bloodstream. You don't get protection from heart attacks from conventional NSAIDs. 11% were on Tylenol and another 21. So 21% were mismedicated. Now, of course, again, secondary prevention's the tip of the iceberg. There are more people that would benefit from primary, but remember, the absolute risks of the patients in primary are the same as in secondary. The absolute benefit is lower. So if we look at the major trials in primary prevention, we see more or less similar results. But what? Why are you so hesitant then to say that people should take it? Why am I so hesitant? Because the absolute benefit in secondary is high. In primary, it's low. The absolute risk in secondary is low compared with the benefit. In primary, it's similar to the absolute benefit. So, you know, people love this number needed to treat, but just bear in mind, a number needed to treat is only a function of two things: how big the effect size is and what the absolute risk is of the population in that trial. So obviously it's much lower in primary than it is in secondary. But that's not the real problem we face with aspirin. The real problem we face is that of the almost 100,000 patients randomized, only less than 5,000 of them have 10-year risks of above 10%. 95% of the data, the average risk of the patient is 5%. And here we're getting to the question of, how do I know that the benefit to risk is going to be favorable in the population that's to be studied? We have three or four such studies going on, but until then, I must say that my view, which is strong, is that you should decide whether the patient's absolute risk is sufficiently high to warrant the absolute benefit they'll get from aspirin. Only you can make that decision, and only you can do it on the totality of evidence. Aspirin irreversibly acetylates. This is the work I'm doing with Manas and Jen, Sarah Wood, Pat Hebert. There are GI and bleeding risks, no liver or renal risks. The conventional NSAIDs, ibuprofen, there's a reversible inhibition of the vessel wall and possible inhibition of the effects of aspirin. Not apparently an increased with naproxen, which is Aleve, but a much higher GI side effect. A possible inhibition of the clinical benefits. So from a clinical perspective, if a person is on aspirin and other NSAIDs, take the aspirin at least 2 hours before. But there are more GI risks with the other non-steroidals than aspirin. The COX-2s were developed to decrease those GI risks, and in fact, they're less, but they have prothrombotic effects. But in the randomized trials, bear in mind that useful to generate questions, that in fact, the effects of ibuprofen, which is Motrin and Advil, Voltaren, diclofenac, their risks of cardiovascular outcomes are higher, about 1.6, than we observe with Celebrex and Vioxx, which is about 1.4. Naproxen in the meta-analyses shows no increased effects. Now, Steve Nissen did a study called Precision. Unfortunately, it had very low rates of follow-up and low rates of adherence. He came to pretty similar conclusions from the meta-analysis, except he suggested there might be a hazard of naproxen. So we come to the unhappy conclusion that once again, it's in your hands. You've got to make the best judgment for your individual patient based on the totality of evidence. There's observational studies on prevention of cancer, but happily, in the Dartmouth studies, randomized evidence, aspirin will prevent the development of colon polyps, will prevent the colon polyps that exist from turning into cancer. That's the closest to randomized evidence we have with aspirin, observational studies on others. We have observational studies that those who take aspirin every day have less loss of cognition than those who don't, but this needs testing and trials. So in conclusion, you have in your armamentarium the ability to treat cholesterol, blood pressure, cigarettes, body weight, and physical inactivity. It's not easy to achieve, but with these drug therapies, you could reduce the risks more. These risks are substantial. My friend and colleague, the late Bill Kennel, one of these landmark findings from Framingham, you can see when you add those risk factors together, 1, 2, 3, 4 of them, you see that the risks now are like a person who's already had a heart attack. They tend to use the Framingham risk score in most assessments, but this, just remember, they don't include BMI, they don't include level of physical activity. They don't include family history of premature events, which in a first-degree male 55 and under or a woman 65 and under doubles the risk beyond the risk factors. So it's your astute clinical judgment that has to come into account. You cannot rely on just the rules that are set up for you. And unfortunately, most people would rather take a pill than avoid the harmful lifestyles. When our aspirin findings came out, here's our metabolic syndrome smoker at McDonald's with his New York Times saying aspirin will reduce his risk, saying a double cheeseburger, large fries, and a jumbo Coke. Oh, yes, and an aspirin. I got to take care of the ticket, you know. What we'd rather you do with this patient is tell him to take an aspirin every day, but before you swallow it, take it out for a brisk walk. So in conclusion, you are the backbone of the medical care system. There is no substitute for your astute clinical judgment. The trials are necessary for the guidelines. I've sat on guidelines committees. I've sat on panels with chairs of guidelines committees. And sometimes guidelines are made based on astute clinical impressions, even when randomized evidence is there. They're of crucial importance to provide guidance. They're not the sole factor in your astute clinical judgment. Just remember, don't ever forget, you know more about this patient than anyone else in the entire world, and it's your judgment that should carry the day. There's no randomized evidence, no guidelines, just guidance to you. You're the final judge and jury. So I thank you very much for your attention and would be glad to answer any questions you might have. Sir. Yeah. I think you make a great point. So I tend to agree with you. I feel that while there's so much emphasis on monitoring the liver, it's the muscle where the symptoms lie, and I'm much more comfortable getting a baseline CK than I worry about baseline livers, but if a person has metabolic syndrome, I'd get it, and if it were up, I'd monitor it, and with some hope that it would go down. But I think your point's an excellent point. And I think another thing in terms of your histories, for the residents especially, is when the person does have an elevated CK, take a detailed history of their activity. They may not think they're active, but you may elicit activity that they're not aware of. The most common thing I find in Boca Raton is the personal trainer. They don't consider the personal trainer being exercise because it's their personal trainer, but it elevates the CKs anyway. Yes, sir. Yeah, well, this is a tough one because you certainly don't want to make them worse and based on their symptoms. But the reality is that a lot of the patients that present like this are overweight, don't exercise, and have all of the stigmata, their heart attacks and strokes waiting to happen. So my own view is that if I could get away with it, I would start with the highest doses of rosuvastatin or atorvastatin in the highest risk people, and then basically titrate them downward. But in the kind of patient that you're describing, I might start them on 5 milligrams of rosuvastatin once a week and up it to twice a week and see if I could get them up somewhere where they could tolerate it. Because the problem that we've got, the people who have these symptoms are also generally the heart attacks and strokes waiting to happen. Yes, sir. Oh, Mitch.
How do you dose for primary prevention? Do you dose to get an LDL out of goal? Do you dose to reach a maximum?
Well, you raise a very good point. You know, DeWitt Goodman started as chair of the committee and gave way to Scott Grundy, who's now given way to Neil Stone. And up till NSEP 4, it was always to a goal. But now they're accepting the notion from the randomized evidence that the lower is better, and there's no threshold below which there's no incremental benefit. So my own view is, in an individual patient, to try to get it to the level that they can tolerate with the drug that they'll take. So the actual guidelines themselves are moving away from the goal now and moving more towards lower is better and there's no threshold below which you don't see benefits. Sir.
Is there an age at which you would discontinue to use some statins?
Well, that's an excellent question. I'm sorry that my colleague and friend Joe Auslander is gone because we might not share the same view on this. And he is the geriatrician, and I'm not. However, the randomized evidence in the Oxford meta-analyses include people randomized up to 84 years of age. So if you're treating in those meta-analyses, the people who come in at 84, by the end of the trials are 89. If you look at those subgroups, and Dawn Sherling and I have published on this recently, you see the same benefit in the people in their 80s that you see in the 70s and 60s. Well, what does this mean? Well, if you're seeing the same relative benefit up till the high 80s, the absolute benefit is even greater. But what Dawn and I have opined is that in trying to deal with an elderly patient who's on a statin, that's a different story from someone who's not on and do you want to start them. If they're on it and they're willing to stay on it, you know, that's probably not a bad thing. But the one who you're deciding, should I start them on it, I think you shouldn't be promising increase in life expectancy. You have to talk to them about not just the cost of the therapy, but how they feel about the risk of a disabling stroke or a disabling MI against the potential hazards and the costs. But the short answer to your question is we have randomized evidence into the high 80s showing benefits. Well, I thank you very much for your attention. I'll stick around if anyone wants to ask any other questions. I'll be here for a while.